Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
You know, we've worked our way to this final chapter of Zechariah, and last week we paused at verse 8, and starting at verse 6, we read about changes in nature, or better, a change in the very nature of nature that has, since creation, regulated the universe, especially the earth. And we talked about how at creation, and up to that time that God began to ready planet Earth for life, the stable state of the universe was darkness, at least as how it would have been viewed from Earth. And this itself is something we need to wrap our minds around. When we speak of the universe and creation, the words of the Bible are Earth-centric. The viewpoint is as if someone were on Earth to observe what God was doing. And since the Earth does not give off its own light, then some object has to provide the light if anything like life, as we understand it, can exist. And the Earth, even before God began his creative work developing Earth for sustainable life, was in a state of perpetual darkness. And sure, there would have been some distant light-emitting things, little dots in the sky, like newly formed stars. But just as today, when one is in some rural area and all the lights go out, not enough light for humans to see, to read, or navigate well, nor enough for plants to have the needed photosynthesis to grow and remain alive, and so on. More Earth was and is, of course, located within the galaxy that we call the Milky Way. But as astrophysicists will explain, some parts of our galaxy are inherently very dark. Other parts are so inherently bright, it would blind you. The Earth was and is in a relatively darkened part of our enormous galaxy, such that without our own personal star, the sun, life could not exist in any form that we understand life, plant or animal. And as we try to interpret what is being said in Zechariah 14, 6, and 7, we look to Revelation chapters 21 and 22 to understand that some of what is being spoken of in Zechariah concerns not the end times, but rather later still, when the universe, including Earth, are going to pass away, to be followed by a re-creation event. And in the re-creation, the stable state, as viewed from Earth, will be the opposite of the original creation. Whereas then Earth was dark and without light until God gave us the sun, upon recreation, there is no more need for any light-emitting object, but ironically, the steady state of the Earth will be light. No more daytime and nighttime occurring in a regular cycle. Things are going to be very, very different. And I have not even scratched the surface in speaking about what it will be like. Let's reread from Zechariah 14, 8 to the end. Open your Bibles to Zechariah 14. We'll start reading at verse 8. On that day, fresh water will flow out from Jerusalem, half towards the eastern sea, half towards the western sea, both summer and winter, then Adonai will be king over the whole world. And on that day, Adonai will be the only one, and his name will be the only name. And all the land will be made like the Arabah, from Geba to Ramon in the Negev. Jerusalem will be raised up and inhabited where she is, from Benjamin's gate to the place where the earlier gate stood, and on to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. People will live there. The curse will be broken, and Jerusalem will live in safety. Adonai will strike all the peoples who made war against Jerusalem with a plague, in which their flesh rots away while they're standing on their feet. Their eyes rot away in their sockets, and their tongues rot away in their mouths. And when that day comes, there will be among them great panic sent by Adonai, so that everyone lays hands on his neighbor, who in turn attacks him. Judah too will fight against Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the nations will be assembled, gold, silver, and clothing in great abundance. And a plague like this plague will also affect the horses, mules, camels, donkeys, all the other animals in those camps. And finally, everyone remaining from all the nations that came to attack Jerusalem will go up every year to worship the king, Adonai Sevaot, and to keep the festival of Sukkot. And if any of the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, Adonai Sevaot, no rain will fall on them. And if the family of Egypt doesn't go up, if they refuse to come, they will have no annual overflow from the Nile. And moreover, there will be the plague with which Adonai will strike the nations that don't go up to keep the festival of Sukkot. This will be Egypt's punishment and the punishment of all the nations that don't go up to keep the festival of Sukkot. And when that day comes, this will be written on the bells worn by the horses, consecrated to Adonai. And the cooking pots in the house of Adonai will be as holy as the sprinkling bowls before the altar. Yes, every cooking pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be consecrated to Adonai Zevaot, and everyone who offers sacrifices will come, take them, and use them to stew the meat. And when that day comes, there will no longer be merchants in the house of Adonai Zevaot. So verse 8 begins yet again, for the third time, with the words, "on that day." Thus it returns us to the end times at the building of the millennial temple. It proceeds to tell us even more about some other radical changes that will happen. And this time the view shrinks its scope from earth-centric to Jerusalem-centric. And in this future age, it is said that living water shall flow from Jerusalem. Living water is Maim Chaim in Hebrew. And when the Bible speaks of living water, it needs to be viewed from the reality of duality. That is, there is both a physical and a spiritual nature to it. From a purely physical side, this is water that moves and is not stagnant. Some scholars say it has to be spring-fed fresh water. I don't think so. The ocean waters can be thought of as living water. The idea of living water seems to be water that doesn't come from a stagnant pond or some other contaminated source, like a mud puddle. It needs to be flowing in some way or another. Now, the spiritual aspect of it is that it is the only water that is suitable for ritual cleansing from uncleanness. And to be clear, it is not that this water contains magical qualities. As with the sacrificing of animals, it is the obedience to the protocols that God has set down that makes it efficacious, not some inherent quality of the animal, its blood, or as with living water, something more holier, spiritual about its molecules than other kinds of water. There will be two flows of this water coming from Jerusalem, one flow to the east, the other to the west. Each flow winds up at a sea. The Western Sea, from Jerusalem's perspective, is the Mediterranean. The Eastern Sea is the Dead Sea. Both Joel and Ezekiel get even more specific. They say the water comes from the temple in Jerusalem. Joel 4:18. Then when that time comes, the mountains will drip with sweet wine, the hills will flow with milk, all the stream beds of Judah will run with water, and a spring will flow from the house of Yahweh to water the Shittim Valley. Now, Joel calls the temple the house of Yahweh. The Shittim Valley is no doubt to the east, as it describes the area around the Dead Sea. Shittim is Hebrew for acacia trees. Okay, they are a desert plant. And in those enormous dried riverbeds of the eastern desert surrounding the Dead Sea and then all the way south to the Egyptian border, these dried riverbeds are teeming with acacia trees. Now, Ezekiel gets into much more detail about this flow of living water, starting at Ezekiel 47:1. Then he brought me back to the entrance of the house, and I saw water flowing eastward from under the threshold of the house, for the house faced east. The water flowed down from under the right side of the house, south of the altar. And next he led me out through the north gate, and he took me around outside to the outer gate by way of the east gate, where I saw water trickling from the south side. And with a line in his hand, the man went out towards the east and measured 1,000 cubits. And he had me wade across the stream. The water came up to my ankles. And he measured 1,000 and had me wade through the water, which reached my knees. He had me measure 1,000 and had me wade through water up to my waist. Finally, he measured 1,000 and it was a river I couldn't cross on foot because the water was so deep, one would have to swim across. It was a river that could not be waded through. And he asked me, human being, have you seen this? And then guiding me, he got me back to the riverbank. And after being returned, I saw on the bank of the river a great number of trees on the one side and on the other. And he said to me, this water flows from the eastern region and continues down to the Arabah. When it enters the sea of stagnant water, Dead Sea, its water will become fresh. And when this happens, swarms of all kinds of living creatures will be able to live in it, wherever the streams flow. There will be a vast number of fish. And for this water is flowing there so that wherever the river goes, everything will be restored and able to live. Then fishermen will stand on its shores, spreading their nets all the way from Ein Gedi to Ein Eglaim. And there will be as many kinds of fish there as in the Great Sea, Mediterranean. A great variety. However, its mudflats and marshes will not become fresh, but remain salty. Ezekiel is telling us that the Dead Sea will receive so much fresh water that will again support life. The life will be so abundant that it will become a great fishery. It saddens me that the Christian church, for the most part, has 100% spiritualized everything about the millennial temple. The water that flows from it, etc., such that it has no physical realization at all. It's all symbolism and spirit. And the reason they do this is if they admit that there will be a real, tangible temple on earth for Yeshua to live and for the Levite priest to serve and for altar sacrifices to begin again, then it demolishes their nearly 1,700-year-old doctrine that the law of Moses is dead and gone. This water flow will proceed day and night, winter and summer, without interruption. Realizing that as it stands today, Jerusalem is quite an arid place, and the water's scarce, this is a pretty amazing prophecy. This goes a long way to explain how much God is going to interrupt and change some of the geophysics of the earth. Again, this is not up for misinterpretation or some later editor's fantasy having been inserted. This is present in the writings of three different prophets, and they all agree. So this is going to happen. Now, verse 9 is not easy to understand. It begins simply enough by saying that Yahweh will be king over the whole world. No problem. Yet, nearly universally, Christendom says that this is actually referring to Jesus. And they are more able to do that because in virtually every English Bible, the word Yahweh is removed. And it is replaced with the Lord. And all Christians have been trained to identify every use of the word the Lord as referring to Jesus. This is fundamentally wrong, and it's intellectually dishonest. From Genesis on, God the Father has been identified as Yahweh. The Son has been given the name Yeshua, and they don't exchange names. The Bible always speaks of them as two distinct entities or persons or whatever other inadequate word anyone might feel most comfortable with. Yes, they have some form of unity, echad, that goes beyond human understanding. We never have a time when one transforms to the other. That is, for instance, when Yeshua walks the earth, he is the transformed Yahweh, and so Yahweh is no longer in heaven. He is now walking the earth in guise of a carpenter from Nazareth. Thus, this is saying that Yahweh will be king over the entire earth. What's different than has ever been? It is that until that moment, Satan had always been given mostly free reign over earth and its inhabitants to go about his mischief. Yet clearly, Yahweh has put some boundaries around what he could do. But with the pronouncement of verse 9, Satan's power over humans is now taken from him. And truly, no other source of spiritual power than God will affect humankind. So once again, the words "on that day" appear, assuring for us this is the end times when this is happening. And here's where it gets tricky in understanding this verse. It says that the Lord will be one, or something similar. The difficulty is highlighted because we see so many different ways this has been translated. The Complete Jewish Bible says Yahweh will be the only one. The JPS says the Lord be one. The King James Version says there will be one Lord, and the Young's Literal Translation says there is one Jehovah. None of those are very satisfying. Now, one way to approach this is to notice that the final words of Deuteronomy 6:4, which forms part of that special communal pronouncement called the Shema, are, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one." Those same final words are what's used here in Zechariah 14:9. This follows the Ten Commandments opening command that says, Yehovah is the one God for Israel. Okay? Now, some Jewish scholarship that especially deals with the more ancient Hebrew word meanings suggests perhaps we need to relook at the Hebrew word echad, as used in several places in the Bible, which is usually translated as unity or one, and allowing for a meaning that gravitates towards a sense of uniqueness, as in one of a kind. Echad seems to work much like we think of the English word one. That is, it can simply mean the amount of one, or we can say that we should all band together and act as one, which more means to share an ideal or a purpose or a single mindset. Not to see that the more traditional way of thinking of it as a unity is necessarily incorrect. It could also mean, in some contexts, that Yehovah is unique for Israel. And this reality is reflected in that Yehovah is the governing party in his covenants with Israel. Therefore, all of Israel's allegiance and loyalty logically belongs to Yehovah. It could also stretch to mean monotheism, the idea that God is the only God in existence, or that he's Israel's only God. So, unique or exclusive as a means to explain Yehovah's nature and therefore our relationship with him might be what's intended here. And yet Christians and Jews today both see this as including the idea that there is only one God in existence, but the reality is the Hebrews of the ancient times thought no such thing. Their idea of monotheism was not that there were no other gods whatsoever, was that Yehovah was the only God Israel was allowed to have. Let's take that one step further. If echad were taken to strictly mean a unity of plurality, as traditional Christianity takes it, then the ancient Hebrews necessarily would have to have had this notion of God as multiple persons or multiple gods, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, which, of course, they did not. It is Christianity that developed the notion of echad that better fits their doctrine of the Trinity. And once embedded in our minds, it can be nearly impossible to consider the meaning and nuance of echad as being anything else. We were told in earlier verses and chapters, as well as in the words of other prophets, that the day was coming that idols and their names would be removed from Israel. Thus, also in that same sense, by default, Yehovah becomes the one God, Echad, because he's the only God left standing. Now, I readily admit this understanding at this point in this context of the Bible, the term echad less meaning oneness or unity, more meaning uniqueness or exclusivity, or as a one of a kind, is not a mainstream Judeo-Christian theological thought. And this is primarily due to the doctrine of the Trinity. Yet if we can assume for a minute that indeed the notion of uniqueness and exclusivity is the more accurate sense of the word echad as used in verse 9 and other similar ones, like in Deuteronomy 6:4, then it seems to become more clear and understandable, if not more rational and logical. Otherwise, we are left with a real dilemma about how to take this verse's meaning, in which, if left as we typically find it in English, is awkward at best. And just as an experiment now, let's insert this alternate meaning into verse 9. Let's see what we get. Zechariah 14:9, taken from the Complete Jewish Bible. Then Yehovah will be king over the whole world, and on that day, Yehovah will be unique, and he will be the exclusive God. Or perhaps, as taken from the JPS, and Yehovah shall be king over all the earth. In that day, Yehovah shall be exclusive, and his name the only one. You see that? Okay, I'm not claiming that this is how it must be. But what I have suggested is well within the bounds of the complex meaning of the word. So, lots to think about. So let's move on. Verse 10 says, all the land will be made like the Arava, from Geba to Ramon in the Negev, and Yerushalayim will be raised up and inhabited where she is, from Benjamin's gate to the place where the earlier gate stood, and on to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananel to the king's wine presses. Okay. The Arava, or Arava, is a long rift valley that extends essentially from the Sea of Galilee all the way through the Dead Sea and on to the end of the Red Sea at Eilat. At least it did in Zechariah's era, which of course was his only reference point. It was marked by a water course that we know today as the Jordan River. For his era, the river that flowed was the main identifying feature. Today, although the geological feature of it being a rift valley naturally remains, the flow of water turns into a trickle at the Dead Sea, and it goes no further. It also means that whereas the lushness of vegetation and the ability to have agriculture in Zechariah's era extended north beyond roughly near to Jericho and a little bit beyond to the south, and today it has become arid, beginning a few miles north of Jericho and then well beyond as one moves to the south. So what this process is envisioning is that all of the land of Israel would become lush and fertile as it was for the Arava in Zechariah's time. Now, Geba is modern-day Geba, and it lies a few miles to the north and east from Jerusalem. Rimmon is well south, somewhat to the west, nearly 40 miles from Jerusalem, and today it's most arid and dry and stony. Thus, the future time will see a full reversal of how we see it today. And when we read about Jerusalem being raised up, see, we must try to visualize this in the minds of these ancient Israelites. From a purely physical standpoint, Jerusalem at 2,400 feet above sea level is literally higher than the more flat tablelands and plains and valleys that surround it. And this reality intersects with the cosmic and the mythical beliefs of the people. We could call it spiritual, perhaps. In that the places where gods dwelled were always the high places. At least the highest place within that local territory. Jerusalem and the temple are the cosmic center, not just of Israel, but of the earth. So this concept of Jerusalem being lifted up doesn't mean that some geophysical event is literally going to raise the elevation. Although that too cannot be completely ruled out as happening. But rather it is primarily an ancient means to express the supreme holiness and ultimate glory of the city, which obtains that from being where the temple of God is located. Now, the remaining point of this verse can be a bit confusing until we remember that as the end times comes to a climax, most of Jerusalem will have been destroyed. Over half of its people gone, either dead or having fled. Therefore, this is about the reestablishment and restoration of both the city of Jerusalem and the repopulation of it by the Jewish people. Truly, exactly where Benjamin's Gate, the Corner Gate, the Tower of Hananel, and the King's Wine Press were located is but guesswork. And there's no need for me to just add further speculation. The point is that the curse on the city will be lifted. Jerusalem will once again be richly inhabited by Israelites, and the people will dwell there in peace and full security because God will ensure it. This is expressed in verse 11 when it says, people will live there, the curse will be broken, and Yerushalayim will live in safety. Now, it's sort of fascinating to me that in Zechariah's era, Jerusalem was intact, well inhabited, and secure. So I'm sure it was disturbing to he and his readers to hear that sometime in the future, and that future could have been months, years, centuries, they had no idea, Jerusalem and its inhabitants would be decimated before it later was restored. And yet, here we are today with Israel constantly under attack. The people living in a perpetual state of readiness and alarm, and peace a seemingly impossible dream. This and other reasons is why I think we are on the threshold of the end times, or have stepped over it into the end times. Time will tell. But what is important for believers is to take the opportunity to know the Bible prophecies so that we can sort out what we see happening and make sense of it. If we are in the end times, then we have a general roadmap of what to expect, if only we'll access it. Yet if we don't look closely at that map, then we'll not understand what's going on around us and in Israel in relation to redemption history. Now, verse 12 changes course a bit. Yehovah will strike all the peoples who made war with Yerushalayim with a plague in which their flesh rots away while they're standing on their feet. Their eyes rot away in their sockets. Their tongues rot away in their mouths. Now, to begin, I think the complete Jewish Bible has taken a bit too literal approach with this verse by saying, Yehovah will strike, instead of, and this shall be the plague. See, the Hebrew word that the complete Jewish Bible translates to strike and everyone else to plague is megapah. And megapa, in truth, the root of the word, does mean to smite or to strike. However, nearly universally in the Bible, it deals with the concept of disease and physical maladies and suffering. It is viewed as being a divine punishment. And further, the divine judgment of all sorts of physical afflictions that stems from the idea of plague is said in Scripture to be sword, pestilence, and famine with disease as well. But disease was not looked at as we do today medically as caused by viruses and germs. It was always something spiritually caused. So for English speakers, the better sense of the word is indeed plague. Now what we are to picture is since all the world's nations were involved in attacking Jerusalem, then nearly planet-wide, there will be a massive social upheavals that will bring down governments and decimate populations. And it will be due to these plagues that God will inflict upon humanity, except for the nation of Israel. It'll be Egypt all over again, only this time on a global scale. So what is it exactly that the remainder of this verse is describing? Historically, and even in modern times, and more than ever, pandemic disease can erupt quickly and catastrophically and spread rapidly. And when we read this prophecy carefully, it is a little ambiguous as to whether this plague is part of the ending phase of the War of Armageddon or it is following it. So that makes it also a bit ambiguous as to whether these consequences we read about are from disease or from weapons of war. We have flesh rotting away on living humans, eyes rotting away as well as tongues. Now, it's trendy in modern days to assign this to the effects of nuclear war. I lean away from that because the words and tone of this passage is of a malevolent force coming from Yahweh that's causing this. And the way God has done this historically is to take naturally occurring things in nature and to greatly amplify their intensity and to make them happen at his command. There's no reason to think that modern technology is in any way necessary to inflict the terrible effects that are described. We are already aware of gruesome diseases like Ebola, other flesh-eating maladies, and they tend to evolve to become even worse over time, outpacing our ability to produce vaccines or treatments. And when we read the book of Revelation, we get a more detailed view of the end times and what concludes or immediately follows the War of Armageddon. Revelation chapter 8 deals mainly with the cosmic changes, the upheaval of nature and the geophysics of the earth, as we've read about, although briefly, here in Zechariah. Revelation 9 then shifts to the topic I'm currently speaking about in Zechariah, as it's important to collate all the pertinent prophecies, especially about the end times, to get a fuller, more fleshed out picture. Let's read just a couple of verses in Revelation chapter 9 that I think adds to what we just read in Zechariah. Revelation 9, 6. In those days, people will seek death, but not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. See, this seems to connect well with the statement in Zechariah that their flesh rots away while still standing on their feet. So the idea is they remain alive and conscious with these horrific things happening to their bodies. And surely, says Revelation 9:6, these people will want death, long to die because of the terrible pain they are in, but they won't be able to die. In other words, God will prevent these millions, perhaps billions, of afflicted people from the relief that death would bring. Revelation 9, 20 and 21. The rest of mankind, those who are not killed by these plagues, even then did not turn from what they had made with their own hands. They did not stop worshiping demons and idols made of gold, silver, bronze, stone, and wood, which cannot see or hear or walk, nor did they turn from their murdering, their involvement with the occult and with drugs, their sexual immorality, or their stealing. So some of humanity will die from the plagues. Others will be like the walking dead who cannot die. And yet many who see what is happening will still refuse to acknowledge Yahweh and certainly also Yeshua. And instead, as Pharaoh, harden their hearts even more and keep right on doing the worst sins and committing idolatry. Now, I want to pause to present you something that I can only offer as opinion, but nothing I can claim with certainty is inspired instruction from heaven. This is a point at which I think there is some resemblance of what both Zechariah and John the Revelator are saying to the Tim LaHaye concept of those left behind. It is my belief that it is upon the opening of the sixth seal judgment that we turn the page from a time of men's evil run amok, causing the most indescribable and inhumane inflictions of suffering upon one another, what the Bible calls tribulation, to when God intervenes and begins to pour out supernaturally his divine wrath. It is my view that this is the moment that the rapture of God's believers and worshipers will occur, and not before. As believers, we are guaranteed to suffer tribulation. But we can also count on not suffering God's divine wrath. Thus, despite the average Christian's belief that generally all church attenders will be whisked away from the horrors to heaven, in fact, it will only be those who have a sincere trust in Yahweh and Yeshua and who follow their ways. And like LaHaye, I see that there will be a large number of those who think their faith is manifested to God by belonging to a church and living however they please, that will be left behind to endure God's wrath right along with all the others. I don't know where that line is between casual, non-saving trust and a true, sincere saving trust as God sees it. So I advise you to be most introspective to determine where you stand, to make the needed corrections while there's still time. I mean, to use Yeshua's verbiage of being one of those who are least in the kingdom of heaven, that is, getting in by the skin of your teeth. And if you're satisfied with that, you might have overestimated. It's a tiny step from the least to disqualified. Verse 13 pulls us back again to the fact that this has nothing to do with Zechariah's time, everything to do with the end times. When that day comes, there will be among them great panic sent by Yahweh so that everyone lays hands on his neighbor who in turn attacks him. When that day comes is a synonymous phrase equal to on that day. And considering what we're reading, we can rightly extrapolate that this is happening in connection with the plagues that God is sending upon the nations. There's going to be tremendous loss of life and property, and even the wealthiest won't escape it. And while panic is not a poor translation, the Hebrew word meoma is most usually used to describe some judgment or another from God. It speaks of panic in the sense of great confusion and chaos caused by terror. So the them has to be the Gentile nations, and what happens is that the people are befuddled, bewildered. They don't know what to do or who to turn to lead them or correct the deadly mess they find themselves in. In dynamic translation, instead of purely literal, a good way for a modern Westerner to think of it is as a holy terror. That's the sense of the phrase, a panic from Yehovah. Now, this holy terror goes hand in glove with the flesh-eating plagues that have been described, as well as the seemingly impossible situation whereby the nations are certain they've won the war against Jerusalem, with so much of the city destroyed, the people killed, others having fled, that they relish in the spoils of war. But just when they think it's all over, the Lord intervenes, the nations are defeated, and then the curses for having harmed God's people begin to take hold. And despite what their leaders might say to their soldiers and civilians, how can one explain away the changes in nature and topography in the heavens above, the horrible plagues, and the snatching of certain victory away from them? Now suddenly, an inexplicable sense of dread and confusion overtakes the soldiers and the people. It can only be supernatural. And many will realize it must be from the God they cared so little about. Laying hands on one's neighbor is meant in a violent sense. It speaks of a struggle. And this sort of thing happens when people are afraid. And when we do, where possible, a reciprocal action will come back upon us. And I suspect that this isn't something where people just go crazy and start attacking their neighbors for no good reason. This likely will be about acute shortages of food, water, and shelter, insufficient hospital availability and staff to handle the massive influx of patients that will arrive. The idea of a neighbor against neighbor fighting over meager supplies is what I picture here. Now, such a thing is neither new nor modern. It has happened throughout history. This could be military activity, or it could be civilian vigilantism, or perhaps both. Now, on the surface, verse 14 says something that is rather hard to wrap our minds around. It says that Judah is going to fight against the residents of Jerusalem. Therefore, I think the complete Jewish Bible has this wrong. The King James Version has it, and Judah shall also fight at Jerusalem. The Young's literal translation says, and also Judah is fought with in Jerusalem. This makes much more sense. There is nothing we have read to this point that sets the nation of Judah against its own capital city. In fact, the final verse of Zechariah makes the meaning of verse 14 as Judah and Jerusalem warring against one another impossible. It says, and every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah have been holy to Jehovah of hosts. That is, Judah and Jerusalem are spoken of as a unit. Together, this is meant to represent the entirety of the covenant nation of Israel, here called Judah. I mean, who else would be holy to God? The entire verse reads, Judah too will fight against Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the nations will be assembled. Gold, silver, and clothing in great abundance. Earlier in Zechariah, we read of the nations plundering the people of Jerusalem and Israel. Here the situation gets reversed, and it is Israel who's victor, and thus wins the spoils of war. And although gold, silver, and clothing are mentioned as that which is confiscated from the enemy by Israel, by no means does it exhaust all the possible items to be taken from the vanquished. It is merely meant to be representative of the full range of everything the soldiers and the civilians had. All right, we'll stop here and complete the book of Zechariah the next time we meet.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.